I was thinking of someone's name.
Here to here. Here to him.
Okay, yeah, so. Yeah, I think about 20 years.
Let's get going.
Yeah, if I have to wear the cocktail parties and evening gowns.
So, remember where we are?
Think high.
Where are we? We are on the 25th. The neuronal function, so we're going to keep going. I want you to kind of pay attention ahead of time down here as we go through. Hopefully you're getting some enjoyment out of the study music, right? Helps you out.
Where the Beatles, in case you don't
know about Beatles. Alright, so you get some music there to help you study. We won't ask you questions of the lyrics or anything. Alright. But then, you see over here, maybe lecture quiz, right? Getting you ready for this. We might just move it up a week or so, but I'll let you know ahead of time. Just why we do that is to make sure you all come to class, study a few points, right? But then, think about this little mouse if you haven't seen it yet, okay? And then what happens the week after that? We have this wonderful day of exams. And where are we taking these again, just to remind you? In the lab, right. And you probably won't need the full 3 hours, but the idea is just to decompress. We have more room, you know, 20 or so students per class. And so that's a lot easier. You're not crammed. And there are going to be different questions, right, for your exams. But how many times or how many different ways can you ask, you know, the shape of an action potential and how does an action potential come? So you might see those duplicated, but a little bit different kinds of questions. So they're all going to be different types of questions. And I'll put up the test bank to the, like, 150 pages or whatever that is. But just to remind you, so nobody can say they didn't see it, what do we have up here?
Old exams.
And these were done a long time ago, but the shape of the action potential hasn't changed really since 1950, okay? So, you know, those, and these summer exams are more like your first exam. Because why? In the summer, when we taught this course, we had time for open exams, open response questions, right? And, you know, smaller classes, like 15, so I could actually grade 15, you know, multiple open response questions. We have 100 students here with the four sections, so it's going to take me some time. But I'm going to try to spend that weekend to really grade your test very quickly because the following week they didn't want to have lab, but we're going to use that lab time the following week because I don't want you to waste time. So my suggestion is to look over these, download these, start looking over them, and don't just look at the first exam. Go to the fourth exam too. Why? Because that was a cumulative exams, right? And so you get some other questions that you might think about. And I would really seriously try to write out the answers to these questions so you don't have, you might think, oh, I'll just do this. But that's not the same way to study it. If you really write it out and then you see your deficits that are on there. One other thing, we want to go back to the schedule. Where is this? Yes. Yes, they're all like 1, 2, 3. They're just all together in there. So I just put those on your web page, and then you can click on those. It kind of goes around with the lecture, hopefully what we cover. And then just to mention, and you all can call me Robin, too, you know, first name. I don't know your last name, so otherwise I got to call you Miss something or Mr., you know, give the receipt. We're all together, team effort. All right. The following week, after your exam, when you're totally stressed out, and waiting for your grades. Hopefully everybody makes an A. I'm not trying to curve anybody to a 70 or anything like that. Okay, so then we go back to the lab, but we're going to do something fun. We're going to actually go over to the Outreach Center over at the med school. And has anybody been over there before? Margaret McConnell's group and where PEP is and all that. And then we're going to play with some hearts and lungs and brains and all that good stuff. And then we're going to go over your open exam responses that you had. So each section we'll go over, and we'll go over your exam answers. So it's really kind of, you know, important to go to the labs those days because that will help you to make sure you understand maybe what you missed or any questions that you have. If I was ambiguous in those questions and you thought of a different way or you read something differently, this is the point that we're going to have to discuss. So we're going to utilize that time. But we're going to use those labs over in the Outreach Center so we can meet in our regular lab and we'll walk over together, just, you know, across the street, get a little exercise. Okay, so that's the general plan in case you're planning ahead of time and thinking about what you want to do there. And my craziness of starting off kind of in the middle of PowerPoint 2, in case you've already downloaded, or PowerPoint 3, I started about halfway through that PowerPoint because it was already up. So I wanted to just go over the first part of that PowerPoint that I skipped, make sure we cover some main things. And, you know, membranes, cell membranes are just fantastic. And I kind of jumped ahead a little bit on that earlier. So think about how many membranes, how much tissue that really is in your own body. If you spread out all the cells, right, and you had all that membrane, that's a lot of membrane. So your one of the textbooks actually mentioned a chimp brain, for example, has, like, you laid it out, the surface area, like 3 soccer fields. That's a lot of membranes, just in the brain alone. So that's pretty amazing. So a very thin layer, right? But what's in these membranes? Remember the bilipid from your cell biology class, your freshman biology, a bilipid membrane. And you can see this in electron microscopy right here, for example. And inside the cell, outside the cell. This is a really neat technique, electron microscopy. People don't use it anymore, but it was really powerful in its day, and it still is. But you would stain up proteins and lipids with the osmium tetroxide, and then it would stain dark like this. So when electrons go through, to understand electron microscopy, when electrons go through, if that's dark, the electrons wouldn't go through and would not develop the film, right, basically. So it looks black. It doesn't get exposed. So everywhere where these black regions are is where proteinaceous material is, or really thick with lipid content. So that's kind of neat. Okay. So bilipid membrane, and, you know, this was a Nobel Prize to understand that this membrane is not rigid, that it actually can move around, and proteins move around in that bilipid membrane too, but there's so many uniqueness properties of the biological membranes, and it's really important to maintain your membrane integrity. But this is kind of neat. So you have some proteins that are ion channels, go right, you know, pass ions through. They might have regulation, they might be closed or open, right? And they might be voltage dependent, the voltage across the membrane, or they might be opened by some mechanism intracellularly that activates them or phosphorylates them, could open up. Or maybe it's just a receptor that's not an ion channel, but something might bind to it, cause a conformational change, and trigger a second messenger cascade inside the cell. So these proteins are really quite amazing that are across the membrane. And then you see these other kind of structures, these proteins with glycoproteins on them, and that can give this cell a lot of different properties to be recognized by other aspects in your body. Also, it's kind of like a post office address or your mailing address. Like if you lived on a certain street and you had your address, these glycoproteins are very important for development. And like a neuron growing to the muscle fiber to know I need to innervate here and this is the right spot. So these could be cues that you're in development that are very important for developmental biology. Anybody had development biology in here? Did they talk? Are you taking it now?
No, I think
did they talk a little bit about targeting and path recognition stuff? Kind of like with these? Okay, maybe. It's all coming back, but it's been a while, you know, a few beers back and you know, everything's forgotten. All right. And then these little ghost-like structures are really quite neat too. These are your cholesterol molecules. So cholesterol is very important in the biological membrane because it can vary the rigidity of the membrane. And sometimes this is a little confusing, and I put a point on our webpage about this too, because in some textbooks, it will tell you something a little bit different than what we cover in here. And so I want to make sure that we hit that point too. So what allows this membrane to be fluid? It's the, you know, fluid mosaic model. And what allows it to kind of move around, these proteins to move around? And you don't want it too loose, right? Because what would happen if it's too loose? You know, sodium would go into the cell, potassium would spill out, calcium would go in, maybe amino acids would go out. It wouldn't have any potential across the cell. So that could be a problem. So what do you think could regulate this rigidity? Anybody remember those synapses back from cell? Yes. I promise I'll bring totes of coffee one day. All right. So cell development.
Maybe saturation of the fatty acids.
Saturation of the fatty acids, and we'll cover that. Another component, I can tell you haven't downloaded your exams yet, because these are questions on the exams, past exams. Can't we? Yeah. All right. Any other things? Like three main things we should remember that you could write an open response question. Somebody?
Temperature.
Really important. Temperature, right? You raise the temperature up, it's going to become more dynamic, right? Fluid. Cholesterol is a key element as well. So this is what's a little bit confusing with these little ghost-like molecules in here, this cholesterol. And I know it can be confusing, but maybe the way to remember it, where you won't forget, is what if we were going to go do an outreach event, and we went to a kindergarten class, and we're going to teach them about science or something, right? And you walk into that kindergarten class with these little rug rats, little children, right? And you walk in there, how good is it for you to move around? How well can you move around? It's kind of hard, right? So think of the cholesterol like these little kindergartner kids. It keeps you from moving around. Now, I know this could be a misconception because why? This, you would think, breaks up these little interactions, right? But in your cell biology book, they will mention that higher cholesterol increases membrane fluidity. But it's actually, and that's at high levels. But that's in bacteria. But under a physiological range, for animals, increasing the cholesterol decreases the membrane fluidity. So it's just something to remember. I know it can be a little confusing because conceptually you see this, but when you actually do the measurements on biological membranes, you'll actually see that the more cholesterol, as long as it's not too crazy, actually decreases the membrane fluidity, kind of increases the rigidity. And then temperature, you can imagine, increase the temperature. And then we'll talk about the carbon chains here in a minute, the long fatty acid chain. Okay, so these remember the bilipid membrane and the way this looks with a lipid moiety, the polar head, right, because of the phosphate groups and the long carbon chain, right, that's important. But what does this actually refer to, just to make sure we're all on the same page? This carbon chain is saturated because it has all the hydrogens on it. This carbon chain is unsaturated because these two carbons don't have the full capacity of two hydrogens, right? So what happens? It makes a kink. I know, back to chemistry. You purge to go, right? So that double bond there makes a kink. So that kink, if you had a nice tight arrangement of van der Waal forces together, this is why that cholesterol is confusing, okay? If you had a nice arrangement like that with your fingers all together, but all of a sudden you put a kink in there, and now they're not having that nice van der Waal forces interacting, you've increased the membrane fluidity. So by having non-saturated carbon chains, you increase the fluidity. All right? So if they're all saturated, you have a tighter membrane, more van der Waal forces, and a tighter membrane. Okay, there's another factor that's not mentioned in some textbooks, but they've shown that this is the case in animals that they looked at going to high temperatures and low temperatures, is actually they can have different length carbon chains. So some of the lipids will have long carbon chains, and some would have shorter chains. What do you think that would do to the membrane fluidity? If you had a mix of lengths of carbon chains, would it increase fluidity or decrease fluidity? Decrease. Because there's less interaction going on. And this is why that cholesterol is still a little bit confusing, right? Because you kind of think that blocks all that interaction, but it actually goes up. So what's interesting to think about with this is, you know, the cholesterol molecule and the bilipid membrane, all that good stuff. Does that make sense to everybody? Kind of? Okay. And then you see the cholesterol. Okay. But I want to, let's go over here for a second and kind of think about this.
You have a mix of lengths. You said that decreases
membrane. If you have a mix, it will decrease membrane. No. Sorry, what did I say? Did I confuse myself?
Can you confuse me?
Yes, thank you. So if you have a mix, it causes it to increase the membrane fluidity. If you have a nice, even carbon chain lengths, and they're going to have nice van der Waal forces, then you strengthen the bonds, so you have less fluidity. If you have multiple different length carbon chains, that will increase membrane fluidity. Was that what you were saying and I confused you? Yeah. So now we're really confused. So anyway, so the mixed length of carbon chains will increase membrane fluidity because it decreases van der Waal forces, okay? And so I know it can get a little crazy sometimes. All right. So let me try to think about something else. If you had cell biology, I think what's really neat too is you think about the cell, right? And if you're talking about this, I know my drawings are bad. This is why PowerPoint's so good. You're thinking about these, you know, carbon chains and making up the bilipid membrane. But how is it that you can change these? Anybody remember? And are, you know, these bilipids, they're not there all the time. There's a turnover rate, right? You have a nucleus, you have the ER, right? Anybody remember from cell? How do you change the bilipid membrane? How do you put structures into the bilipid membrane? Yes, that's exactly it. You can actually take pinches of the membrane off, right, and take it back inside the cell. And then little vesicles that are made with the Golgi can actually then go into the membrane. And what's really interesting, when you think of the bilipid little vesicle that's in there that can fuse to the membrane, the way it bridges in the membrane, right? The one thing I want you to think about, there's an enzyme called flipase. You might remember this from cell biology. Actually, that can flip molecules onto the other side of the membrane. So that it's a protein, it's an enzyme. You can actually look at the messenger RNA expression level while you change the temperature for the cell culture or that animal, if it's an ectothermic animal, and you can see the expression of flipase go up. And you can actually look at the membrane structure, and you can see it change as that enzyme goes up, then the membrane changes. So it gets you the idea that membrane's very dynamic to change the structure of that membrane to put different kinds of lipid molecules in there. Okay? Does that make sense to everybody? So I'm trying to integrate your cell biology, your other classes together to make sure that we are all on the same page with this. But I think that's pretty cool that you can look at the expression of an enzyme level and then know what it does and then see how it affects the membrane. And then you can look at how long that animal, you know, takes before it can condition itself to that temperature. And you probably, you know, with this cold weather, you can think about the insects out there, right? When they sense the cold, they can start to change their membrane structure, maybe even make antifreeze proteins, but that takes time. So if you don't have that seasonal change to come along, and you had a cold snap really fast, you could kill them out, right? Because they don't have time to condition themselves. So would that be acclimation, adaptation, or acclimation? So those are things to think about, okay? Remember that back to the first PowerPoints that we covered? So this is something I want you to remember too, okay? Try to integrate that together. So these membranes are really important because this is the properties that they can keep ionic differences across from the inside to the outside of the cell. But of course, they're only susceptible to, you know, pressure, blowing up. It's just like if there was too much hydrostatic pressure, you filled up that cell, that membrane can only stand so much. So it's kind of interesting to think about these aspects. And if you looked at changing, like, the osmotic concentration in your body, right, or in a dish that you're culturing, that could affect the membrane structure. Let's just think about it in another way. Let's say you have a lot of coffee, which is good for you, and you had a lot of coffee, or if you're above 21, you had alcohol to drink, you know, and then you had to go to the bathroom a lot, right? And so you lose a lot of water. What happens to the concentration of your salts in your body, in your plasma? They go up. So your osmolarity goes up, right? Well, that could affect your body, right? So if you're dehydrated, that's really bad because your osmolarity is up. And that can change the cell structure. But your body kicks in and says, I need some water to drink, and then stop maybe the urination if you haven't had too much alcohol because that it promotes the urination. So you drink some more water, you dilute those salts, and then you're back into an osmotic gradient again. But let's go back to the mechanism, just to think about it a sense, and what we just covered with the membrane. How does your body know what your osmolarity is? Anybody? Your body knows the osmolarity in your plasma and in your fluids. How does it know that? Let's think about how do you detect that? Anybody remember maybe from vertebrate endocrinology or another physiology course you've had? I have to have my coffee, so I have my caffeination. Yes.
It's associated with the renin-angiotensin feedback loop.
Yes, that would be the trigger, the angiotensin, renin-angiotensin system for hormonally controlling to maybe increase your water intake or water excretion. But how is it mechanistically that you detect the osmolarity of your plasma? That you know that you have to drink water or something else, increase your thirst, for example. So what would increase your thirst? What would drive it? Your kidneys? Your liver? Your heart? Your brain? Your brain, right? Your brain's going to tell you, I'm thirsty, right? Right? So your brain's going to tell you are thirsty. So hint, hint, what inside your brain would then detect the osmolarity to tell you, behaviorally, I got to go get some water? Pardon? What's inside your brain besides blood vessels and glia? Something that's really neat? Neurons, right? Neurons. All right, so we got a neuron, which is a cell, right? Now, what did we just learn from this? About what we were just talking about with water and high, you know, osmotic pressure. If the cell, like a red blood cell, this is, you know, I'm trying to get you to pull, where is that thing? There it is, red blood cell. What would happen if it's in a dilute environment around it? Let's pretend this red blood cell is a neuron now. All right? So that's a neuron, and the fluid around that neuron is hypoosmotic. Hypoosmotic compared to inside the cell, right? So you always have to compare it to something. So if it's hypoosmotic, lower osmotic concentration, what's it doing to that cell? That it's higher salt inside the cell, so water wants to go in, and what's it going to do? Expand. Well, what's in the membrane of cells? Proteins, right? What we just talked about, proteins inside the cell that goes across the cell membrane. Those proteins could be an ion channel. If you open it up, how do you activate some channels? What did we tell you yesterday, last time we met? How do you detect the mechanosensory stimulus on your skin? What's that sensory ending have in it?
Pressure.
Pressure that you're detecting. What are those channels called?
Mechanoreceptors,
another name for them. Stretch, activated, ion channels, right? So stretch-activated ion channels. So you have stretch-activated ion channels in this membrane right here that can detect the osmolarity around that cell. And this is how you detect your osmolarity. And then that neuron's going to change its firing rate because ions are going to go in and cause that neuron to fire, electrical signals. It's no different than this red blood cell being in a hypotonic solution. And if you get too high with osmolarity, right, and you're dehydrated, then it's not firing as much. So that neuron, would you expect that neuron at rest to have any activity? Let's just think about that. Conceptualize. If you wanted to build a device like a thermostat, would you want it to be able to sense only higher temperatures, or would you want it to be able to sense low and maybe high? A range, right? So think of this neuron. Would this neuron probably have a basal firing rate at a normal osmotic concentration? And then if it got slower or higher, it changes how the system's going to work, like the renin-angiotensin system. So this is exactly what happens with those hypothalamic neurons. They detect this, and there's this basal firing frequency that goes on. If it goes lower, it knows that something's happening here. If it goes higher, it knows this is happening. And it changes your whole behavior, like for thirst or endocrine responses. So this is what I'm trying to integrate. You know, we've learned about cells, we've learned about proteins in a cell, but let's pull it together. And how do you detect, like, that osmolarity difference in your body? And this is how it happens. So it's really quite cool. All right, so let's go back to this craziness over here. Just the idea, if you increase osmotic gradient, you know, that's going to change the hydrostatic pressure. Okay, so we know that. But what's really neat about these this membrane is that it can regulate which ions go across that cell, right? So at rest, inside cells have higher calcium, potassium, sodium, higher potassium. And outside the cell, higher sodium. Why is that? Because the cell is more permeable to potassium at rest than it is sodium, for one thing. We'll talk more about that. But if you have a concentration gradient that you develop, then you can have a electrical gradient as well. So if a cell is more permeable to one ion compared to another ion, that's going to set up a difference in the concentration gradients. But this is a good example here about this minus. Just think this is a protein, okay? And let's think this is a beaker with a semi-permeable membrane. But the protein's so big, it can't go across the membrane. But proteins in general are negatively charged, okay? So if you put a negative charge over here, what's that going to do to, say, potassium? It wants to stay around the negativity of that protein, right? And your cells are half of the mass of protein inside the cells, right? So what's it going to do to the chloride? If a negative charged protein is coming here, it wants to repel it, right? So now, just because you added a molecule that's not permeable across the membrane, but it has a charge, you set up a concentration gradient of the other ions. So you see how that comes together, all right? So we're going to talk more about that as we go along, but I want you to think about not having a permeable membrane to one particular molecule, then can set up a concentration gradient of the other molecules. All right? And I don't want you to memorize these numbers, but you should have a general idea for, like, this muscle cell. Now, on the webpage, I listed some other ions and their concentrations. When we get to that part, we'll have some memorization that we have to do. But in general, higher sodium outside the cell, higher potassium inside the cell, higher calcium outside the cell by magnitudes. And even this is probably not low enough. It's usually like 10 to the minus 6 or 10 to the minus 5th in a lot of cells. And then chloride is higher on the outside as well. And then proteins, this A minus basically is like for proteins, okay? And that's higher inside the cell. How to remember this where you'll never forget it again? If you were jogging and you're exercising and you're sweating, and let's say you tasted your sweat, what does the sweat taste like? Table salt. What's table salt made out of? Sodium chloride. Okay, so outside the cell, sodium chloride, high outside the cell. Just add calcium to it. Now we won't ever forget that. Okay. I know it's corny, but anyways, we got it. So what's really neat is if you looked at different animals, particularly invertebrates, you can think about their environment that they live in and then kind of get an idea of these different concentrations. So let's just look at the squid first. So squid's an ocean, a marine animal. And if you look at the concentration of sodium, so over here, this concentration of sodium outside, say, the cell, a squid nerve, it's very high, 440 millimolar. That's really high, right? Sodium. It's pretty close to seawater concentration. And what else is high outside the cell? Chloride. And externally, potassium is pretty low. And guess what? In seawater, potassium is pretty low too. So actually, outside the cell, in the animal's extracellular fluid, ECF, I remember on a test one time, people didn't know what that was, but extracellular fluid, ECF, extracellular fluid, is pretty much like seawater in the squid. But let's look inside now. This inside of the squid, potassium's really high, and sodium's pretty low. Now, let's go over to an amphibian, the frog, mussel, just some numbers that we have here. We see that the sodium's a lot lower outside, and chloride's a lot lower, about the same as the sodium. And then you see over here, potassium's higher. But look at the magnitude difference between the squid and the frog, the amphibian. So generally, marine invertebrates, their extracellular fluid is very much like the seawater for marine invertebrates, generally. Always exceptions, but in general. But look at the ratios. The ratio of sodium to other inside to out isn't so different, like in the sodium. It's still really high on the outside, so inside to out up here. It's really high on the outside in both these cases, right? So it's the same, it's just relative, just a shift, right? Just kind of a shift of higher range, lower range. But the ratios, relatively the same kind of orders. this was really advantageous to the early researchers that were working with understanding how neurons work or how cells work, because Hodgkin and Huxley and Keynes and these gods in the field that really we owe a lot of homage to. We should all just like clap our hands together. Mm-hmm. All right, these guys were great. They actually understood the ionic differences across cells and understood how the squid axon works, and then understood how our nervous system and how our body works. And then Sidney Ringer came along and did a lot with the heart and understood how our heart would work by working basically on frog hearts earlier on. And you're going to do some of those experiments too. But they were really fortunate because they could take out the squid axon, which they actually thought was a tendon initially in their research because it was so big. It was like the size of your pinky, you know, thickness, but long, depending on the size of the squid. They could take that out and put it right into seawater that they just took out of the ocean. And it would function because extracellular fluid was very close to seawater. So it's kind of serendipitously, by accident, that it actually was working for them. And then they understood a lot of principles that we'll go through as we go along. So try to know the general points here. You don't have to memorize numbers, but the general take-home message of this kind of table. All right, and we've already talked about what would happen, you know, with osmolarity. And you know what would happen to your red blood cells if you put it in distilled water, right? You put a red blood cell in distilled water, what happens to it? Boom, pop, right? It breaks because it's going to have a higher osmotic situation inside, right? So that's why you don't want to be dehydrated or too much hydration, right? Water's toxic, right? You remember the football players a number of years back in Louisville that died? They were exercising. It was a high school, and there was a case in Texas. Crazy science teacher. Should have been shot, I guess. Sorry, I didn't say that. But she was crazy. She had these kids do a competition, how much water they could drink. So she got distilled water and had them guzzle distilled water. They drank it, and some kids died from this because it was a competition of how much water they could drink. So she was like, how fast they could get this system out. You're going to have a pee lab. We call it the pee lab here, but we're not making you, you know, drink a lot of water. We watch you carefully, too. But what would happen? You drink a lot of distilled water. That goes into your GI tract, into your blood. And what's it going to do to your osmolarity? Dilute it out, right? So people die of hyponatremia. Low sodium, hyponatremia. Remember natremia, you know, back in your chemistry for sodium, kalemia for potassium, right? So hyponatremia, and they died. And people in Louisville died from this too, at high school was a number of years back. While we're on this tangent, something that's crazy, but just to put it in context too, maybe you heard a number of years back some musician in England that died, that she was going to go on her ecstasy trip, you know, MDMA. Don't do it. You know, it kind of was on campuses at one time and then it dropped down, but it's bad for your brain, damages your brain, so don't do it. But ecstasy, one of the problems was that it stops sweating and then you overheat. So people, if you go to some rave concert and there's little mist things flying out of the air and dropping water on you, you're probably going to get some bacterial infection in your eye too from it. But anyways, the other problem is, and Listeria is a big problem that is in those kind of things and they can be very toxic to you. But anyways, besides that, if that's probably an indication there might be ecstasy going on in those rave places. But so this one gal thought, okay, since I'm going to overheat, overhydrate, and I can't sweat really well, maybe I should drink a lot of water before I do this ecstasy trip and then go dance all night long on a Friday, right? So she drank a whole bunch of water, and she died before she even got to the place. So not a good thing to drink too much water. Hopefully I've made the point here, and you don't want to do ecstasy too. All right, and we'll get more into how that works as well. All right, so you get the idea of transport and ions, and we've talked about this a little bit already. You know, you could have a carrier that takes molecules across. You could have an ion channel. It might be a symporter where two ions go together. It might be an antiporter. One ion goes one way, and the other ion goes the other way. So that could happen, too. And then you have pumps. Anytime you hear of a pump, that means ATP, like your sodium potassium pump. An exchanger doesn't necessarily mean it needs ATP, right? But an exchanger is going to be, the gradient is going to be set up by the pump, right? So the gradient is set up by the pump and then allows other ions to move across depending on that gradient. And then you might have some passive diffusion. So what kind of molecule could be a passively diffused across the membrane? Well, not too much water. because that would, it's probably going to go through the channels, maybe through the potassium leak channel, because there's a potassium leak channel, and it can go either way. So it can go through. Gases are a good one. And this is the only thing you have to remember from organic chemistry. You know, lipid soluble molecules might go through. What about steroids, like estrogen and testosterone, right? They can go through membranes, right? Because back in my day, when we cover endocrinology, everybody used to always tell us there's no receptors on the surface of the membrane for steroids like testosterone and estrogen. And they always had to go inside the cell and bind to a cytosolic receptor and then have an action. But then they discovered there are receptors on the surface for steroid molecules, but steroids can go in. And when you think about that, you know, if you take an injection of testosterone or estrogen, it's just going through all your cells because it can go right through the bilipid membranes, right? So it's kind of, and gases like CO2 or carbon monoxide, right, can go right through, or nitrous oxide. All right, where's my little thing? Okay. So I don't know if I'll ever get through this. But the idea is, if you have a passive, you just keep on going through the membrane. If it's transport through a protein, you're going to reach a saturation, right? Doesn't matter if it's a carrier or you know, some kind of active sodium-potassium pump, for example. Just like if the bell rang or we had a fire in here, everybody's going to run out that door, but it's going to saturate, right? You can only get so many out at a time. So that's the thing to think about with this. Okay, so we've covered all this. Basically, semi-porter, anti-porter, going to go fast. These diagrams are a little confusing because you think only 3 to 2, but generally 3 to 2, try to remember that. Now, this is really neat. So we should kind of pay attention to this. We're changing over time. We're seeing how much sodium, if you have, you were looking at alanine, an amino acid, right? And we're looking at how much alanine can go across the cell. If you have zero sodium outside, it really doesn't go up very much, right? But if you add sodium outside the cell, then you can have a high gradient, a high transport of alanine outside. So what does that tell you? What's the take home of a figure like this? What would that mean? That alanine by itself really can't go across the membrane. That needs sodium there. So that's kind of neat to think about. And that tells us that it's like this, that you needed these two components there for it to go across the cell, right? So the organic molecule or alanine couldn't go by itself. And what's going to follow an osmotic gradient is water, right? But not just trickling through, but probably through ion channels or leak channels more so. Okay, so why is this important? And you got this page that you can pull up, rehydration theory, therapy. And this is really neat. What's the number one disease worldwide that kills the most? That, well, let's see if I word this right. Is the destruction of potential life, the number one killer worldwide of potential life? Well, that could be. So, but I'm thinking just potential life after you're maybe born, right? So from delivery to adulthood, what's the number one killer worldwide that would kill the most people? Pardon? Heart disease? Diarrheal disease? Anybody else? Malaria? Any ideas? Yes? Meningitis could be. That's good. Any other ideas?
Dehydration. Mm-hmm. Diarrhea is a pretty big...
Diarrheal diseases, number one cause of death worldwide for potential life, because so many children die of diarrheal diseases. Why is that primarily the case? What's the problem behind it? Clean drinking water, right? Clean drinking water. So there are activities here on campus, too, that you can get involved with. Shoulder to Shoulder, for example, is a really good one. They go down to Ecuador. They now have a group that goes to India. My daughter did that, for example, went down to Ecuador. It was really quite neat. She was went to the physical therapy program here. But it was really fun, and she got, you know, you get to help people and do things and really get your hands dirty and understand what's going on in the rest of the world. And then you realize how fortunate you are really here. And but she was down there, and the problem was they were trying to work with some clean water programs. But you saw a house up on a hill, an outhouse down here, And then down a little bit lower was the water well. What's the problem with that? All right. And we had that same problem here in Kentucky, too, right? In eastern Kentucky, not that long ago. We had a lot of issues with that as well. So think about these issues. And so why is that a diarrheal disease? Why is that such a problem? Because of dehydration, right? You can dehydrate. If you have cholera, you might actually, it's amazing how much you poop. You just keep doing it. You might lose about 10 liters a day. You can keep being hydrated with cholera, keep getting hydrated, and you just diarrhea, diarrhea, diarrhea. So what does that do? It just pulls the water out of your body, right? Really bad. So it was really just a simple little recipe difference that saved millions of lives. What do you think that simple little difference is that you could save millions of lives? Didn't need antibiotics, didn't need anything else.
Don't they add salt to the water?
Add salt, but something else that's key. Salt and sugar. First therapy to give. Very cheap, right? Salt, sugar, water. Why? What we just covered. Sodium and sugar in the GI tract, goes across the GI tract. What's going to follow? Water. They stay hydrated. Isn't that amazing? So simple. First hydration therapy saves millions of lives. Give them a little salt and give them sugar water.
You hear a lot of people like say that you can boil water to try to...
Yes.
Is that not enough?
Well, that will kill out the bacteria, right? So you don't have the E. coli and other problems in there for the diarrheal disease that they're going to have. But that would work. It's a, you know, the sugar's going to be there and the sodium's going to be there, but you still have to hydrate them, right? So if they already have the bacteria in them and the problem of, you know, the cholera that's in them, then that's going to be already a problem. I mean, we had big cholera outbreaks, you know, here too in Kentucky. If you take an ecology class, they used to go out to the cemetery and actually look at the cholera outbreaks and see the big surge of cholera that we had here. And then you could actually follow the stream when it was going and people taking water out at different towns and how it hit them as it went around. I mean, cholera is a major problem here, too. So the idea is very simple, but you got the take-home point here. Co-transport, water follows. Yes? Good. There was another tangent I was going to talk about here, and I forgot what it was. All right, it'll come to me probably tonight. All right. So, all right, we covered the mitochondria, so now we can keep going a little bit more. How are these channels, why are they selective? What's selectivity about a sodium channel from a potassium channel, from a calcium channel? Or the pump, for example. What makes a channel only allow primarily sodium across or primarily calcium across? What could be the difference? Is it just size, molecular size, like this?
To do with the amino acids on the inside of the
pump or channel. So the amino acids inside the channel, that could have an influence. How could that have an influence?
Charge.
So if you had the, you know, channels are made out of amino acids, it's a protein, right? If you had a lot of negative charges inside that channel, what's it going to do? It's going to pull potassium in, right? But how does it get out of the channel? If it's all negative charges in here, it's going to want to stay in the channel. That's kind of interesting, right? Think about this. But also, are these ions just free, just kind of moving around? Is there anything else attached to these ions? Water, right? And that's why water is really good for us, too. So what does a water molecule do to the size of this atom in here? It's like potassium or sodium. It's called a hydration sphere. So that hydration sphere can change the size of that atom, that ion, to go through that channel. Now, there's a debate in the literature, and there's a whole field, as I mentioned, membrane biophysicists. All they study is ion channels and how they work. There's a whole field in it. And if you're really crazy, we teach a graduate course sometimes in membrane biophysics. And so it's really fun, a whole course just in channel function. All right. So the channels, depending on the charge, the hydration sphere, are selective. And in some channels, they know that you have to pull the energy, you have to pull the hydration sphere off to allow the ion to go through. So that takes energy. But once the ion goes through, it's kind of like domino effect. The other one can push the next one out. The next one comes in and pushes the next one out. And then it's thought that some of these channels, water might be stripped off and water doesn't go through. In other cases, depending on the channel, water molecules follow between the ions. So the point, the take home here, how do ions go through the channel? Charge of the ion, charge of the pore, size of the ion, size of the hydration sphere. Those make a difference, okay? And then, of course, you have to have a gradient for the ions to go across. Okay. So we get the idea here, charge, ions, but then how does that ion come out the other side? Probably the domino effect. And you can imagine the mouth of these channels. If you had a lot of positive charges here, you repel a positive ion, like maybe sodium or potassium. But if you had a lot of negative charges here, then you might attract positive charges, right, to the pore, and then they would go through. So depending on the structure of those amino acids, and while we're on this, think about these channels, too. Some of these are what we said voltage-gated, right? So this charge makes this channel either open or closed sometimes, depending on the channel, because it can detect the membrane voltage across the membrane. So it could actually be closed, and if the voltage changes, then it could open. It changes its conformation based on the amino acid sequence. Now, a long time ago, the people that used to teach animal phys made you memorize all the amino acids, how boring, and which ones were positive charge, which ones were negative, and, you know, basic, acidic, and neutral. Boof. You just have to look that stuff up. You don't want to memorize that, okay? All right, so I think we were here last time. Where did we start last time? We started there. So one other thing to just remember, gap junctions that allow molecules to move across from one cell to the other, and we talked about this a little bit last time, but these are really unique because what are they? There's proteins that can pull together subunits, like you see the subunits here, and they can come together, but they have to then match the subunits on the other side. Isn't that wild? They have to match up just right to then make a pore. That's really cool. So you think both cells have to make these subunits, they have to arrange right, and then on the other side, they have to arrange right. So you can imagine it's probably those glycoproteins we talked about that are cues for those to line up and make a pore. What's the advantage of this? Anybody? What would be the advantage of having gap junctions? Gap junctions.
Communication.
Yes, communication from cell to cell. So they can transport electrical charge right up through, like in your heart, right? You have electrical conduction in your heart. Your nervous system. But in our nervous system, the mammalian nervous system, we don't have too many gap junctions. But when you start to look at invertebrates, one of your favorite animals, which is?
Crawfish.
Crayfish, exactly. Crawfish, crayfish, same. Good. Is a crayfish. Nobody got their tattoo yet, but anyways, if you get a crayfish tattoo, we'll see. Got bonus points. Okay. No, it's all right. So in the crayfish, one of the really neat behaviors, when you start to get play with those, is if you touch on the tail, they tail flip. And that's such, and even if you cut the head off and you just have the isolated tail and you pinch on it, it will tail flip. Because part of that neural circuit for a fast escape response actually uses gap junctions from communication from one neuron to another. We'll cover that more in depth. But when you start to look at animals that can escape very quickly, particularly invertebrates, you'll probably find those fast escape responses that there's gap junctions between some of the neurons. So it won't have the delay to release a transmitter, but it can very quickly allow electrical signals going from one neuron to another neuron. So we'll cover that a little bit later. I don't want to give away all the fun stuff right away. All right. But that's pretty neat because they've looked at dyes and how big these gap junctions are for allowing larger molecules to go through. And that's important because you think of amino acids, energy, glucose, right, and transport of these compounds through one cell to the other. And some of this work in understanding gap junctions and the size of gap junctions was actually done by a guy at Harvard, Ed Kravitz, way back when, and guess the preparation that he used to understand how gap junctions, the size limitations. Your favorite animal is?
Crayfish.
He used crayfish and lobsters in that gap junctions that we talked about for the tail flip, and he would inject different size compounds and see how they go across. That was actually some of the first studies to really understand limitations of gap junctions in an invertebrate preparation that then allowed us to understand how our heart works, how our smooth muscle works in us. So the idea is comparative physiology is very important to understand how we function because you can understand these model systems, which is the idea of what? August. We didn't study it. August. Krogh principle, right? We covered that. You know, an ideal animal, kind of in the extreme, like a desert kangaroo rat that doesn't have to drink water, right? Can make metabolic water. Here's a really good August Croak kind of principle, like the squid axon. So big, you could squish out the cytoplasm and look with it. The crayfish or the lobster in the escape response to understand gap junctions. Easy preparation to work with. Inject dyes, see the limitations. Okay. And this is where we started before when I got off on the wrong start of the PowerPoint slide a long time ago. Okay. So we have a little bit of time. Let's go here. We started talking about neurons in this wonderful preparation of a cockroach, which we're not torturing you guys with this year, unfortunately. Is it okay to show your tip? Yeah, come on up. Let's do it. So, you know, she might get bonus points for this. We're waiting for the crayfish, but maybe you want to tell them about it a little bit. History.
Oh.
It's good.
Okay. Everybody. So apparently I have to show my tattoo. So this is my tattoo. It's for medial cell. It was originally drawn by the father of neuroscience, Santiago Ramon y Cajal. And we found out there's an exhibition at NYU until the 31st of March. So I think some of us are planning a trip to New York. But some of you may have heard of Golgi Sane. Cajal wanted to be an artist when he was growing up. His father was a professor at a medical school. His father wanted him to be a doctor, so he kind of got him drawing anatomy portraits for his class. Cajal thought medicine was kind of cool, and, you know, going into the military, came out, became a doctor, perfected the Golgi stain, and was able to make all these wonderful drawings of neurons, the layers of the eye, and all kinds of cool stuff, and that's why he's a father of neuroscience. And that's my tattoo. Okay.
Great. And that one's permanent. It doesn't rub off, right?
Yeah, it doesn't rub off.
It doesn't rub off.
That's still a rebound part of it.
Yep. So somebody did that here in Kentucky, right?
Yes.
They could all go there. We could actually put them up and tell them, can you do crayfish?
You're going to promote my nephew's tattoo
okay.
shop.
Very good. All right. So where we were with the cockroach, and we left off last time about this. This animal is amazing because a lot of understanding how your nervous system works and the drugs that are used today actually were developed by testing it out on a cockroach. Isn't that amazing? So next time you step that cockroach, you got to thank it before you kill it, right? Thank its cousins, its relatives. Because a lot of understanding of some pharmacological agents that are used in therapy today came from looking at a cockroach. What was really quite interesting, when they first working on cockroach not only for assays of pharmacological agents, they were actually looking at insecticides as well. And it's kind of interesting because when they were looking at insecticides, they noted that some of these, even natural insecticides, would kill out the, you know, insects. But if you had too much, it knocked out humans too. So they wanted to understand, how is it that it's affecting a human, also the cockroach? What's the mechanism of action? So some of these early insecticides that they found, like from herbs and things, they actually tested and found active ingredients and then figure out how they work. And even insecticides today basically work off the same mechanism. But it's pretty neat, the system. And why it was used so much is if you look at the cockroach, they have these little structures out the back called cerci, and there's little hairs on it. There's also something called a plumb blob, if anybody's in engineering here. You know, the engineering tripods with the string that's in the middle and the little weight, it's called a plumb blob, right? They're actually on here too. So that actually tells the animal where its orientation is, right? So it knows what's going on because of the gravity. But they at the end of those sensory structures, what do they have? Sensory ending has stretch activated ion channels in the membrane, right? So if that hair moves, or that little plumb blob moves one direction or the other, it fires, tells that neuron what's happening, goes to the six abdominal ganglion, integrates that signal there, then goes down the ventral nerve cord, like our spinal cord, then goes to activating motor nerves that then can activate the muscles. And that circuit can actually be used without the head. So you can take a little string, put it around the head of the cockroach and pull it tight, headless cockroach, I know. And then you could have them crawling on the floor. Don't do this, it's cruel to the little cockroaches. And you could have them crawling on the floor, and then you could try to step on it. And guess what? This headless cockroach is smarter than him. it can actually avoid you stepping on it. Because this is reflexes that go on in this. When it gets an air wind coming onto these little hairs, it will automatically go the other direction. So it's pretty neat that it has that kind of built-in response. How do you kill a cockroach? Anybody? Water. You're getting into a corner, right? And then you get them, okay? With your cowboy boots. All right, so that's the way to kill it. So it's really neat that a lot of information was understood by using the cockroach system. Not only that, think who funded a lot of this research. The Navy and NASA. NASA funded a lot of this. Why? Because you could take off these little plum blobs that we talked about for gravitational sense that were down here. You could flip them off, cut them off, and then the animal doesn't have any gravity sense, which is like space, right? So what's really amazing with these animals, as they grow, they actually can grow the cerci. That's pretty amazing, right? So now you have an animal that you can take away gravity sense, you can let it grow, and it then develops new gravity receptors. But you can also understand what happens to the wiring in that animal as you took away gravity sense. What happens to sensory projections? How does the animal recondition? Can it do that? What about astronauts in space, right? The big problem is they get nauseous and sick if they don't have the gravity sense. So this is a big problem for some people who are very sensitive to gravity. Anybody go on a roller coaster and get really, you know, sick or car sick, you probably wish to be the astronaut, right? So it's really interesting. This is why NASA was funding this for a long time, to understand how animals could recondition. And they did some really neat experiments, which are fun things to do. There's this cockroach that's out in the Middle East that's kind of a big cockroach, has big cerci, so August growth principle. They would tuck off the plum blobs on one side, and the cockroach, they would take two little monofilaments, like your fishing wire, right, but really thin ones, glue it onto the back of the cockroach, two of them, take off the plum blobs on one side, let it burrow in the sand, and then dig it out, and they would find out it would make a swirling effect this direction. Take them off on the other side, it'd make a swirling effect this side. Let it kind of condition for a month or so, and then it could dig right. So it learned and reconditioned itself, knowing it didn't have gravity sense on one side. So how long did it take? Was it restructuring in the nervous system, or was it just transmission, or was it understanding the synaptic connections? And this is where people are still working on this animal to understand some of these neuronal circuits and if they could rewire, or if it's just firing patterns that are different. So that's pretty cool because that fits to us, right? If we lose the sensory modality, how do we refunction? Or was it using some other cues? People that have spinal injury, for example, you lose your proprioception, maybe to your legs, and you can't move your legs, right? Or in some cases, people that had, this is kind of the older days before they knew a lot about the past specifically in the spinal cord, if you had bone cancer, say, in one leg, and it had this pain all the time going on, and you went on those medications, they could go in and actually cut the pain fibers in your spinal cord. But the problem is those pain fibers that go up are very close to the proprioceptors for your muscles to give you proprioception, and sometimes they would cut those too, and then you'd lose proprioception, so you didn't know where your leg was. But from those earlier mistakes, or actually from injuries, they realized these people couldn't walk, but if they looked at their feet, it was no problem, they could walk just fine by using another sensory modality. So it's kind of interesting to think about this redundancy that we have to be able to do things. Okay. Tangents, but important tangents, right? All right, so general points about how neuronal function goes on. We talked about the generation of an action potential, the site of spike initiation, and then transmission. And then remember, graded responses, maybe in the dendrite, are in the sensory endings graded. But as soon as it hits that site of spike initiation, where there's a high density of what? Voltage-gated sodium channel, right? Then you can generate an action potential, and that action potential could go down and then go to the next step, next step, next step. And we'll talk more about synaptic transmission as we go along. The early studies back in the 1700s, hopefully you kind of put some context to this, and you probably heard of these people, Galvani and Volta, remember physics? Right, everybody's purged it, but Volta, galvanic current, all from the earlier work. These people were the pioneers in understanding bioelectricity. So bioelectricity was described by these guys basically by putting dissimilar metals together, touching the nerve and the muscle, causing that nerve to fire, which then causes the muscle to fire, and if they damage a little bit of that muscle, they can activate another nerve, and then that could fire. This was the beginning of understanding how electricity travels through your body. Before this, it was confusing. They thought it was just kind of like magic, or some kind of flow that was in your body. People didn't understand how your nerves work, or how you had electrical communication. In the 1700s, they really started to describe some of this a little bit more. And Volta followed this up with a lot of work that he did. And some of that earlier work, when they started to shock nerves, they didn't have a stimulator like you have in your lab. They made stimulators with static electricity. They would rub dissimilar things together and build up like static electricity, like when you walk on the carpet, and then they would hold static electricity and then touch it together to like activate these nerves. So experiments were really hard to do, right? But it's kind of neat that they could figure out that from static electricity, they could then transfer that to a nerve, which then could cause communication. So we don't want to go through all the history, but there's some really neat history if you're interested in the development of understanding bioelectricity. And Benjamin Franklin was key to this too, because actually he described electricity with the lightning, you know, and the wire and the key and all that kind of stuff, right? Turn the light bulbs, Benjamin Franklin. Actually, Volta and Galvani knew about Benjamin Franklin's work, and they actually set up electrical rods, lightning rods, to collect that electricity from a lightning storm onto their biological prep so they could get the electricity from a lightning storm and see if that was really the case that would activate the nerve. Isn't that pretty cool, you know, to do that all the way through from Benjamin Franklin's work? Okay, so pretty neat. In general, then, how are cells excitable? Excitable cells. This brings back a kind of a crazy memory. But anyways, I was on a plane one time as a grad student going somewhere, I guess to a meeting, and I had this first membrane biophysics class. The title of the book was Excitable Membranes. I'm reading this because we had an exam coming up, you know, ion channels and all that stuff. And this gal next to me was asking, oh, that must be an exciting, interesting book that you're reading, Excitable Membranes. And I didn't quite catch it at first. Then I thought, well, showed her the pages. No, it's all math formulas and ion channels. Then I was a little slow catching on. But anyways, I think now I understand what cougars are. Okay, so anyways, that was weird. But anyway, so membranes can only be excitable if there is a ionic difference across them, right? And so it's really interesting, almost every cell has a resting membrane potential if it's an excitable cell. And you can only have excitation, like for your heart or your neurons or your skeletal muscles or other cells, if there's an ionic balance, something that's going to allow ions to move across that cell, right? So how does that set up? So you have a cell like this, and remember, intercellular electrodes weren't invented until like the late 1950s, and it was by a guy up in Chicago, which described the first intercellular recording with a sharp electrode, a glass pipette like this. Nowadays, it's just common practice that you're going to experience next week. But it's really neat, because then that allowed him to poke it through cells instead of the squid axon by putting a wire down the middle of it, and he could actually measure resting membrane potentials in cells. So as far as I know, every cell, the way it was described with a reference on the outside compared to the inside, negative potentials for resting membranes. And it's just the way. And you don't have to memorize a certain number, because every cell in your body has a different resting membrane potential. Your neurons are not all the same with resting membrane potential. Some neurons have minus 80. Some neurons have minus 60. Some neurons minus 50. Your heart pacemaker cell is probably only minus 20. But other cells in your heart, like the ventricular muscles, are probably minus 60 to minus 70. So you get the point. Don't try to memorize a particular number. But why is it that one cell has minus 70 and the other one has minus 20? That's the thing to try to think about. What's the concept behind that? Why do they have the resting membrane potential? And that's what we're going to go through a little bit. But before we do that, I have an activity that I want us to do. Oh, gosh, so many fun things. All right, so we don't have enough for everybody, but we're going to show around. Well, you did a tattoo, so you can hold a straw. Here, just grab a straw.
A straw.
And grab one bottle.
Sure.
And I'm going to give around, because if you did like the flicker things before, you might want to do something else and then grab a straw. And these are fresh straws, and they're going to do demonstrations. Somebody over here, do one.
Go over here.
Okay. Put your hand over it, and now start blowing. And we're going to do one, two, three, go! And then somebody around you kind of watch to see if it changes color. Let's see what's happening. Did yours change already? Anybody's change? Raise your top up as soon as it changes. Start out with blue. Blue, blue, blue. This one's beginning to change. Let's see. Anybody's change yet? Some people have hot air. If I did this, it would change right away, right? No. Okay. Anybody's change yet? What are we looking at here?
Carbon dioxide
going to the water, changing the acidity, right? Becoming more acidic. But why did some change faster than others? Let's just think about it. Why do you think? What's the variables here? The temperature. It's all about the same temperature, but maybe some people did that. Okay, maybe temperature. Some people's maybe metabolism, higher CO2, right? Maybe some people were really putting effort into it, and then some maybe people not blowing so hard, right? Could that be some of the variables? So this is the nature of science. I want you to think about it. Have you heard of nature of science before in other classes? The study of nature of science, right? Investigation, experimentation, and then trying to decide what it is, right? The variables involved here. So maybe those are really good. Different people, different temperature, different effort, different amounts of CO2. But I can tell you some of those bottles, you could keep blowing all day. That's why I didn't want you to pass out over there. And some of these that didn't change, you could keep blowing in that all day long and it probably wouldn't change. What do you think's different?
There's a buffer.
There's a buffer. Could that be the thing?
That's
right. And then she's going to pass out. Could that be part of it? There's a buffer? What does a buffer do? So what does a buffer do? It buffers what? pH, right? What are the buffers in your body that buffer your pH? What's a buffer in your body? Just yell it out. Your blood, actually your hemoglobin in your blood can bind hydrogen ions. So hemoglobin itself is a buffer. It can bind hydrogen ions. Proteins can bind hydrogen ions. Bicarb is the main buffer in your body. Phosphate is another buffer in your body. So what did I do to torture those people here? I just used seawater, ocean water. The ocean has a lot of bicarb in it. And actually, the ocean is the primary source of buffering CO2 in the atmosphere, the ocean itself, because of the salt water. So it gets the bicarb. So let's think about this. You're blowing out the CO2, and what's happening to your body pH if you kept blowing, hyperventilating, for example? You got so excited to test this thing. You keep hyperventilating, what's going to happen to your pH in your body? It's going to increase, right? Because CO2 comes out. And then that's the problem. So some places, we won't be too crazy about it, but some places people get really worked up at events and they start to hyperventilate and crawl on the floor and do all kinds of crazy things, and they pass out. So now you know why they pass out. It wasn't some mystery unknown force or anything, but it's because they're hyperventilating and it became so basic in their body they've actually passed out. So that's not good, right? So if you hyperventilate, that's going to be a problem. What if you don't ventilate at all? You hold your breath, like we experienced the other day. Also a problem, right? It becomes more acidic because you hold the CO2 in. And then you're going to pass out too. But we've also learned that buffers are really important in your body. Phosphate, bicarb, proteins, hemoglobin itself. All right? So those are really key points to remember. Let's think about some other take-home things that we covered today. Some things to remember. Membrane fluidity. What makes a membrane more fluid? More fluid. Higher temperature. That will decrease cholesterol, right? With increased membrane fluidity. Different chain lengths. And unsaturated. All right, that's good. What allows ions, the selectivity of ions through an ion channel? What are some key elements?
The size of the ions.
Charge of the ion, charge of the protein.
Size of
the ion, size of the hydration sphere, right? And then for an ion to go through, it has to have a gradient. And then even the glycoproteins outside the channel could make a difference, right? And then we talked about electricity, right? And that you can, now we're going to talk about next time about the conduction of electrical events. We didn't get all into the resting membrane potential, and some of you are going to have lab on Monday, but we're going to cover that more on Tuesday. On Monday, you're going to be stabbing cells, right? And remember, you have a quiz to take Sunday night, so don't forget to do that, right? Have a good weekend. There's a seminar at 4 to 5 today if you're interested, too, a neurobiology seminar on endocrine neurobiology right here in your room, 4 to 5 if you're interested.